You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the issue the 16th to the 22nd of July. I'm Chris Havergal. I'm joined by news editor Simon Baker, books editor Karen Shook, and reporters John Morgan and Jack Grove. This week, more than two-thirds of UK universities have been pushed to go further and faster on widening participation by the Office for Fair Access. We'll be considering whether institutions are ambitious enough when it comes to broadening their intake. How would the UK's universities fare if the UK left the European Union? We'll be taking a look at how research funding and the mobility of staff and students might be affected by a Brexit. We'll have our regular roundup of the latest academic titles to hit the bookshelves, and we'll also sample the entries to this year's Times Higher Education Exam Howlers competition. But first, there's been a significant increase in the proportion of UK universities which have been told to do more on widening participation. This comes from latest figures released by the Office for Fair Access. Simon, what do they show?
Well, Offer's latest report, this is traditionally their report where they reveal the sort of access agreements that have been agreed with each university. Basically, the law in England means that if you want to charge more than £6,000, then you have to have an access agreement showing how you're spending your additional fee income up to £9,000 a year on improving the lot of students from poorer backgrounds. And in the last few years, this access agreement has also shown how many people were going to charge £9,000 for at least some of their courses in the sort of following year. Of course, in the last couple of years, that's become almost everyone. I think, in fact, we're down to a situation now where there's only just one of 121 higher education institutions that saying it won't charge at least £9,000 for at least one of its courses or some of its courses. But the more interesting thing about the report this time is that there's been quite a big increase in the number of universities that Offer has turned around and said, yeah, sorry, your initial access agreement that you're proposing, it's not good enough, you've got to go away and have another go. We want to see you doing more to help students from poorer backgrounds. Quite interesting because Les Ebden, the director for Fair Access, has just been reappointed. If some of you might remember, there was quite a big hoo-ha when he was first originally given the role, or at least nominated for the role, because a parliamentary select committee tried to block the appointment, or at least the Conservatives on that committee did. But Vince Cable and David Willetts kind of decided to ignore that and go ahead anyway, and a few years down the line, they're saying the new Conservative majority government reappointed him. But it's now that Offer seem to be taking a tough attack with some universities. And given, you know, there's actually were some figures just out showing that there's now a bigger gap between the number of school leavers, independent schools and state schools that are going on to some of the top universities, then it would seem that maybe this is that something does have to be done.
I mean, certainly the figures look quite striking. Of 121 higher education institutions whose access agreements have been signed off, 83 have been told that their initial submissions were not ambitious enough. That compares to 28 out of 123 last year. I mean, just one final thing on this, Simon. Obviously, it's, by the sounds of it, it's been quite a tough negotiating process. You know, is Les Ebden sort of, you know, happy enough with where Offer has got to at the end of that process, though?
Yeah, I mean, we've spoken to Tim, and he seems that he is pleased. He's called it some. He said some university leaders may have been bruised by the amount of kind of pushback there had been. I suppose we may not know that until we have spoken to some university leaders to find out how bruising those encounters actually were, but. He does seem like he is fairly happy with some of the outcomes that have come from those negotiations. I mean, it looks like kind of spending is sort of down on things like bursaries and scholarship. But for a while, there's been a kind of push for universities to spend more on outreach projects and trying to identify people that should be encouraged to go to university in the first place. But there are some other figures sort of showing that the proportion of spend of that money over 6K is slightly down, I think. Is that that's
I think the figures are it's now 24.7% of the sector's income on fees above £6,000, down from 25.4%.
And I think that probably reflects more than anything the fact that the fee cap has been at 9K and hasn't moved with inflation now for a few years, and obviously there have been lots of calls for that to change, and the government has pledged to allow universities to put them up in line with inflation, provided they can prove that their teaching quality is good enough, which is of course another kettle of fish entirely.
Yeah. All right, well, plenty more on this issue to come in coming months, I'm sure. One thing we'll certainly be hearing more about is the referendum on the UK's place in Europe, whether it will stay in the European Union or not. There's going to be a referendum by the end of 2017, and universities are gearing up to play a key part in this. John, for our cover feature this week, you've been looking at what the key battlegrounds might be.
That's right. So, as you mentioned, Universities UK is going to have a major campaign around the referendum, and it's going to be called Universities for Europe. So, no secret there that UK is going to be pushing for people to vote in the referendum for Britain to stay in the EU. And the arguments there from universities are that UK universities benefit from £1.2 billion a year in EU research funding. Horizon 2020, the EU's current research programme, is worth about €80 billion in total over its 6 years. And there's important benefits for the UK from that. And there's also benefits from EU membership in terms of researcher mobility and student mobility, in that you obviously don't have those visa obstacles for people to move around from the continent and come to the UK. And also there's specific programmes like Erasmus Plus that help with student and staff mobility by giving financial support to people who want to come to the UK or people who want to go from the UK to study and work on the continent. So Universities UK's argument is that there are real benefits for individuals in British society from EU membership via the support they give to universities. And one of those people I spoke to was José Manuel Barroso, the president of the European Commission between 2004 and 2014. It's a shock. He thinks Britain should stay in the EU. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that he said was that there definitely, in his view, would be a loss of research funding, loss of EU and global research networks, and there'd be damage to faculty and student mobility if the UK did leave the EU.
When you were working on this feature, did you get a sense of whether the sort of debate around universities' relation to the EU was something that had the potential to become a really key issue in the referendum campaign? Or when we talk about sort of the wider, you know, public perception of the campaign, is it all going to be about borders and, you know, whether your bananas have to be straight enough to be sold in a supermarket?
I think it's likely that a lot of the debate around the referendum will be focused on immigration, but that does link in perhaps with the freedom of movement issues that are key for universities as well. And one of the things that I also looked at in the feature is sort of the key opposing arguments on the other side, fact that universities will be challenged on their arguments. And
is there a much of a no campaign in UK universities?
I think the feeling is that predominantly staff and students will be voting for the Britain to stay in the EU, but there are the counter arguments that universities will encounter. Spoke to one UKIP MEP who was arguing that Britain could in fact pull out of the EU and just put the money that currently goes into the EU research budget into its own research. And that there's also the argument that Britain could, if it did leave the EU, strike an agreement as an associated country, like Norway and Israel do, and still take part in the European research programmes, although they're not EU members. Mm. And the UKIP MEP, Jonathan Arnott, also argued that there'd be benefits in terms of students, British taxpayers wouldn't have to subsidise the fee loans to EU students anymore, and British universities would be able to charge EU students, you know, the full market rate as they do for overseas students, which would actually bring more money into British universities. So the arguments that British universities will make in that campaign, they will really be tested.
Sure, we can read more about that on page 32 of this week's magazine. Karen, we're getting towards the summer holiday season and people will be wondering what books they should be reading. What can you offer this week?
One of our reviewers recommends that we read about a study conducted by Gunter Jekeli about why young urban Muslim men in Europe don't like Jews. Our reviewer, Aminul Haq from Goldsmiths, looks at this book. Interestingly, one of the three groups that are looked at there are Bengali British young men from East London. Aminul has written a book on that subject himself. There are a lot of troubling things in there, but also cause for hope. He says there are at least some people who were spoken to in the survey who said that human beings are human beings. Willie Maley reviews Gordon Teskey's new book, The Poetry of John Milton, and not surprisingly quotes Karl Marx on Milton, who says that he produced Paradise Lost as a silkworm produces silk. Lalita Murthy from the University of York reviews a fascinating book by A. Anish called Neutral Accent, How Language, Labour and Life Becomes Global. It looks at call centres in India and the neutral accents and many other things that people who work there have to adopt when they're speaking to people in Preston. Also have a review by Daniel Sands of a new collection of essays by Judith Butler. And this week's book of the week, I think, will be of interest to anyone working in higher education. It's called Pedigree, How Elite Students Get Elite Jobs, written by Lauren Rivera. She is at the Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern University. She went. She looked at how Ivy League universities and blue chip Wall Street firms have a very close relationship. And in fact, it appears that a lot of these blue chip firms have kind of outsourced the first tranche of their hiring processes to the universities themselves. So taking the concept of the Oxbridge milk run one better. And what we discover, among other things, is that while many of these firms have government contracts to participate in diversity and they attend diversity fairs at universities and elsewhere, they set these things up but never hire from them. What it comes down to is people hiring people like them, people they play with. And The Economist reviewed this book and said once you look past the Marxist theorizing, this is a good way to find out how to make it to the top. The author doesn't agree with that, but what she does say is that Marx don't matter. You got to play the right sports. You got to have been doing that a long time ago. Helps if you're white and male, and obviously from a wealthy background. So there's a lot of data to back that up. Also this week we have a book review from somebody who might, I suppose, be described as an early career scholar. His name is David Willits, recently had a career change.
Late career politician.
Does he face the same issues as other early career
I have to ask him about that. He is now a visiting professor in the Policy Institute at King's College London, and he's reviewing a book by Jenny Bristow, who is at Canterbury Christ Church, called Baby Boomers and Generational Conflict. I asked him to review the book because, as some people will know, he himself wrote a book in 2010 called The Pinch, which is about the baby boomer generation and whether they stole their children's future. As reviewers said at the time, and we made it a book of the week, Sir Howard Davies reviewed it, it's unusual in a book for a politician in being evidence-based and a solid work of scholarship, and indeed it helped to set the agenda for subsequent scholarship being done. The author of this book, Jenny Bristow, acknowledges her debt to Willits and said that that was one of the key books that sparked her interest in studying this. So she had a lot of complimentary things to say about him. He has fewer complimentary things to say about her book, but we're going to have a chance to hear both of them talk about this issue because later this month I'm going to have both of them in to have a first debut books podcast in which I have not only the reviewer but the author in the room, and we're going to be talking about these issues. Are baby boomers greedy? is this a construct? Does it have to do with increasing inequality, or just those guys banging on about Woodstock and their fat pensions?
Sounds fascinating. And finally, it's the competition that brought us Sinister Buttocks, Stalin's Buffet Zone, and something intriguing called Genital Mixing Action. It's the Times Higher Education Exam Howlers competition. And Jack, you've been taking a look at this year's collection.
Yeah, so we've got a very varied and fun collection this year of exam howlers, and our readers have been going through thousands of exam scripts at this time and spotting a few gems within there. A couple which I particularly like. One was the David Cox from the University of Wolverhampton. He recalled how one student had remembered the gunpowder plot, saying that it was one of the most memorable events in English history, and it was celebrated annually with the chant "Remember, remember the 5th of December," which
not that memorable.
I think another a good one is one regarding the university professor Kevin Warwick, a bit of a maverick. He had a silicon chip placed under his skin. He described himself as the world's first cyborg. One student recounting this said that Kevin Warwick had a chimp implanted in his arm. And we've got various other ones.
Don't give them all away.
I won't give them all away. I mean, I'll just say more generally, surprising lack of smut and coarse humour in this bunch of entries in the exam howlers. Normally that's pretty much all we get, but not a single one.
There's always next year.
I know, that's quite disappointing.
Saving them up.
So I wonder, you know, whether students are less sex obsessed or whether.
But their capacity for typos continues unabated.
Well, all I can say is that there's nothing of the level of a few years ago when there was a slightly different take on the West Bank, I think I remember. Seem to remember, which I'm not going to sort of repeat it here, but look in our archives. Nothing really is quite as smutty as that this year.
And check the Google stats. What are people looking for?
Yeah, exactly. These students need to up their game.
Well, there are plenty more entries. There's an article in this week's magazine on page 7. You can find that article and all the others we've been discussing online at our website, www.timeshighereducation.co.uk. You can also join the debate about the articles in this week's magazine. We're on Twitter, at Times Higher Ed. We're also on Facebook and LinkedIn. But that's all for this week's Issue Review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.